Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 345 for September 2 of 2016. Slower sales, slower semis, and stuff about self-driving. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Mr. Vasilash, we find ourselves here again.
Indeed we do. It's a great day. I-275 is done. Those of us on the west side just love that. Driving smooth, driving fast. It's great.
The audience doesn't care at all. There's a local freeway open.
Oh, come on. They're all over it.
But we do. So we got to tell everybody who has joined us for today's Autoline After Hours. We've got Mike Martinez and Mike Whalen, both from the Detroit News. And good having you guys here.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Always fun to be on.
Mike and Mike.
And so you guys do a webcast, too, called All Mic'd Up.
We do a weekly podcast. Every Monday we air a new episode, and it's kind of Mike and I talking about the oddities and anecdotes of the industry.
And you guys are both automotive journalists. You both cover, so tell us about your beats.
So I mainly cover a Ford Motor Company, and we all, you know, interact and help each other out. And then also autonomous car.
You agree with that, technology? That he helps you out?
Right? Sometimes. Yeah. I think our colleague Melissa Byrne helps out more than anybody.
Uh-huh. So, right. Ford and autonomous cars and?
Fiat Chrysler and the Union, as well as dabble in autonomous cars and just anything else that really needs help with. I know Mike was on auto sales today as well, so yeah. Helped him out a little bit with that with Kelly Blue Book, but you know, it's just fun stuff, as you guys know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sales. Is this the end of the longest recovery in the history of automotive sales?
You know what? It might be. Things are starting to slow down, but is that really a bad thing? I'm not so sure. Ford's Mark LaNeve had a really, really great quote last month. He said, trees don't grow to the sky, right? This growth is going to have to stop at some point, and you're starting to see that a little bit.
Yeah. Sales were down, what, 4.5%, I think, across the board?
Around there, around down 8% at Ford, down 5% at GM. Fiat Chrysler surprisingly eked out a 3% gain, but then most of the other majors were down as well.
So this is their new reporting regime. Is this the first month that they used that?
Or did
they
use it last?
Second.
And
whose new reporting regime?
FCA.
Fiat Chrysler.
Where they're telling the truth.
Retroactively changed their sales. And according to Kelly Blue Book, they would have actually been down 3% under the former regime for reporting sales.
Hmm. So. Well, I thought the way it worked out was that it was going to be more accurate now.
It is, and so, I mean, it's it's an internal system that they've been using. Marchione addressed it last week for decades, and they just weren't exactly reporting them as they should have been or as accurately as they thought they could have been. And they now have a full new system, and they retroactively redid all of their sales for the past 3 or 4 years to kind of match that. Mm-hmm. So
interesting. Well,
so I found...
Hey, hold on. The control room says we've already got a phone call.
Wow.
This very topic. So let's bring it in.
This is Clem Zarobsky, Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question for the gentleman is, why is the new Camaro not selling? Is it design, practicality, cost? I would like to hear the professional's opinion. Thank you.
You know, it's interesting he mentioned that, because one of the anomalies that I pull out of this thing is it's, you know, historically Camaro and Mustang have been neck and neck, and you know, really trying to best the other one. So calendar year to date, that Camaro sales are 48,000. Mustang, 81,000. I mean.
And that's a surprise, because when they redid the Camaro, everybody thought, okay, yeah, Mustang took the sales crown in the muscle car wars for a year, but 2016, Camaro's going to shoot past them. That
right.
hasn't happened yet.
I mean, it's an enormous difference. I mean, it's, you know, 40-some percent greater sales of Mustangs.
Yeah. No, look, I think Ford nailed it with the design. You know, I love the new Camaro, but everybody, not me, everybody else seems to complain about the visibility in the car. They feel like they're sitting in a bathtub. They don't like the visibility. I wonder if that's something that basic is what's hurting sales of the car.
So people are just getting in it and saying, I don't know, I can use this as my daily driver.
They also, I mean, changed production to Lansing for the new generation, and I'm not sure if I don't know this for sure, but if production has had anything to do with it, if they've been slowly ramping up more so, especially at the beginning of the year, to make sure everything was solid with that production.
I think the Mustang just nailed it. So we did hear today GM just announced they're going to bring the Camaro to China, which I find interesting because Ford's had the Mustang there for about a year.
Sure.
And I don't think they sell much of anything. But I'll bet it does bring people into the showroom. And, you know, we mentioned this on Autoline Daily today when we did the exit interview, as it were, with Ed Welburn, who used to run GM Design. He pointed out that in China, the Camaro is very well known because of the Transformer movies.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
In fact, he said, because GM's had Camaros over there, he said, everyone points and calls it the Bumblebee, because that was the character in the Transformer
right.
movie. He says, the Bumblebee name is better known for the Camaro than the Camaro name is for the Camaro.
Mm-hmm. I've been extremely surprised. At the beginning of the year, Mike and I do predictions for the year, and one of my predictions was that the Camaro was going to outsell the Mustang and kind of get that crown back, because I liked the Mustang, but it's very smooth, and it almost went from a little bit more of a muscle car to a sports car, while the Corvette for the new generation went from more of a sports car to a muscle car with the hard angles.
Mm-hmm.
And I really thought that the Camaro, with the new chassis and everyone touting it so heavily, that it was just going to blow out Mustang, and I've been completely wrong on that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, unless they start just giving them away, it would be hard for them to catch up to what Ford's doing. But, you know, another thing that was interesting to me today in the sales is Silverado sales are down.
Yeah.
Okay. So, they're down.
Like all the pickups flattened out.
Well, they flattened out, but what's interesting is that, okay, so, I mean,
except
so
for the Nissan Frontier.
Well, we're not talking the mid-size, though, but I mean,
the mid-size guys, they all went up.
But, I mean, so you've got, okay, Silverado at 380,000 and change, right? The F-Series, 528,000. The Ram up 5% to let's call it 309,000.
Wow.
I mean, it's doing incredibly well, and so what's up with the Silverado?
Yeah, I don't know. And you know, it's interesting because this is why FCA wants another plant for the Ram. They smell blood. They can't build anymore right now. Otherwise, they might be knocking on the door of Silverado sales.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's look at fleet sales, though, too. How much of those were fleet sales? Because GM for months now has been saying they're cutting fleet sales, they're cutting daily rental, they're focusing on consumer.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't buy GM's argument in this case, because when you get into trucks, I mean, if I'm a commercial owner of some sort and I want 20 Silverados, that's a fleet sale. I'm sorry. And for GM to pick on anybody selling fleet on the truck side of the business, to me, is crazy. On the car side, I understand. And anything to daily rentals, I understand. But, you know,
So what do the Ford guys say about the success of the F-Series?
Oh, well, of course they're going to tout it. You know, they always...
No, but I mean, is it just...
We are geniuses!
Exactly. But you look, and going back to the fleet thing, Ford said that, you know, fleet's good for us. We like having that, so we're not going to
commercial fleet, not
exactly.
Daily rental.
Yeah,
when you break it up, there's
and government fleet is another good one
that work really well for them. But F Series was down this month, although it's still a little odd because when you compare it to last year, obviously they were ramping up production. You're just starting to get inventory, and it was an all-time high
mm-hmm.
Last year. So it's very hard to compare,
right.
You know, this year and last year,
mm-hmm.
but. Yeah, no, they've knocked it out of the park with the F-150 and the redesign. And Mike was just test driving the new engine and transmission yesterday for the 2017 model. So they're not exactly resting
on
the laurels.
Wait a minute, he's the guy who covers the Ford beat. What the hell are you doing in the new F-150?
He was up in Saginaw, so they had a track event with the new second generation EcoBoost 3.5 liter, mm-hmm. as well as the new 10-speed transmission that they co-developed, at least the hardware for, with GM. And yeah, they had us racing, drag racing F-150s towing 9,900 pounds. to show the difference between the 2016 and the 2017. And, you know, I actually really do like the Ram 1500 with the air suspension. I think it's a great ride. I think they did great on that pickup. But the new F-150, I've kind of knocked down a little bit with the aluminum and the doors not slamming as they should be. But with the 10-speed transmission, I think it's great. I mean, taking that up a hill and towing 9,900 pounds and just laying out full throttle, it opened my eyes a little bit to what that vehicle can do and how Ford's trying to make these major plays to stay on top.
What do they mean, second generation EcoBoost? What'd they do to the engine, do you know?
They've got hollowed out camshafts now, so they took weight. The weight's about the same. But they added new technologies and they said 75, 80, 90, most of the engine is all new. And they added new technologies while keeping the weight the same. They went into a lot of the technical details, but it's got 10 more horsepower, 50 more pound torque, and it's paired with the 10-speed transmission, which will be offered across the trim lineup and standard unlimited and the Raptor.
And so the 10-speed, I would think, would give them best-in-class fuel economy for a gasoline engine.
That was one of the things I was kind of poking around on with him, and I was waiting for him to say, we are going to be the king of pickups again for fuel economy performance, and they didn't say it because the EPA numbers aren't official yet. But, I mean, when you look at a 6 to 10-speed jump,
that's
usually 3 to 5%, I want to say even for the 8-speed, I believe, instead of a 10.
Right.
So we'll have to see what happens there.
But they increased their horsepower to 375, so that went up 10, and then they increased the torque to 470, which is up 50. So you might begin to think that, well, maybe the fuel efficiency wasn't exactly what they were going for. And maybe what they were doing is they're going for people who are going to be dragging racing with big loads behind them.
There you go.
But maybe not, you know, because a lot of times when you add more power, you can upshift sooner,
right.
Turn the engine slower, get better fuel economy that way. So there is an argument where you can use power to actually improve fuel economy.
Mm-hmm. Have you heard any rumblings around in Dearborn about the fuel efficiency of the F-150? Because when the aluminum one came out, I mean, you know, we talked about it on the show about, wait a minute, where's the big boost in fuel economy from the weight reduction? And they didn't have it. So it would seem to me they'd be sensitive about that.
They didn't, and they're keeping it pretty locked down so far. But I think they sort of downplayed it last year with the whole aluminum switchover. They said that's not the most important thing for our customers. Our customers care about towing. They care about, you know, capability and, you know, putting things in the bed and taking it from one place to the other. And if you get 1 mile per gallon less than maybe the competition,
right,
it's not such a bad thing.
Well, your guys over at Ram made a great hay out of their capabilities compared to...
They did, and I was going to say Chevy really enjoyed putting stuff in the bed of the F-150 with their ad campaign that we talked about last time.
But that backfired, though. I mean, you look at the next month's sales, F-150 was up, and
right.
Chevy was down.
Right.
Yeah. But, and you were talking about performance and what Ford was going for. Look at GM, who's putting the 10-speed that they have, that they jointly developed, not the software, into the Camaro ZL1 for 2017. So it really looks like the play for this transmission currently is the performance aspect and not maybe necessarily the fuel economy aspect, the first generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was some good news, I think, for General Motors, I think, in terms of sales, that the CT6,
okay, Cadillac.
The Cadillac, the new Cadillac.
The current flagship.
The current flagship.
It's not really the flagship, but for now it is.
Let's assume model your flagship.
Let's assume it's going to be the flagship for some time to come. But year to date, 4,048, okay, which is not a big number.
No.
But at least there's not a negative sign in front of that number because it's a new product. But here's the thing that I thought was very interesting. I looked at the sales of the MKS, and it's 4,083, right? So here you have this car that's just ramping up for Cadillac, right? And you've got the MKZ, which is, you know...
MKS.
Or MKS, I'm sorry.
That's what, okay.
And it's not doing so well. So I predict CT6 will be Cadillac's selling sedan, unlike the ATS and CTS.
I would argue that it will be for now, since it's a brand new thing and it's ramping up. But I don't think Cadillac has the traction yet. Maybe the Escalade does, but the Escalade is everything they don't want that brand to be anymore. So I think Cadillac and Lincoln are still having some troubles.
What do you think?
I think that has the potential to do that. But let's talk about Lincoln.
Yeah,
they were like the lone bright spot in Ford's lineup this year, which you don't get to say very
often. But so, yeah, and I don't mean to interrupt. Cadillac was up too, and it's the XT5 that's doing it. But go back to Lincoln. Yeah, they were up 7% or
about
something
7%.
Like that. A strong performance.
I think 50% jump, 49 point something or so for the MKX. MKZ was down. I believe.
And what's with Navigator?
No, MKZ was actually up 7.1. They sold 183 more than they did last August.
There you go. Yeah, Navigator.
Navigator just never, it came out a year after the redesign of the Escalade, and it just sort of fell flat on its face.
You need to add those gullwing doors like that concept.
Then the Navigator was an evolutionary refresh, though.
Yes, right.
The Escalade was a full redesign.
But I would expect sales to at least match the old model with the Navigator, and they haven't done that.
Sure.
Well, and the new Cadillac, actually, the concept that they unveiled recently, that I think looked really good, but it seems like every 3 years Cadillac has a new concept that will be their flagship and design vision for the future. But it just, do you really need a new design vision every 2 or 3 years?
No. Actually, I think it's the same design language that they keep tweaking. These cars look very similar to me, and we are starting to see that kind of styling end up on their production cars with, like, these light blades, as they call it, the arrangement of the headlights and the running lights and all that. Absolutely came right out of the concept cars. So I thought Cadillac did pretty good, but, again, two new cars in the lineup, T6 and XT5 really made the difference.
It's a big difference. But, to the point of Lincoln, though, I begin to wonder, if you look at the delta between Cadillac and Lincoln, I mean, it's still fairly substantial. And do they think they're going to make this up, or do they just look over to the Ford building and say, damn, the Mustang's really kicking Camaro's ass?
I think so. They're the first ones to admit that this is a journey, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to take a very long time. And Michelle Krebs has said this is like going from 0 miles an hour to 5 miles an hour. It's baby steps, mm-hmm. right? But the new stuff they have coming out, it is, has been a hit so far, the C and the X, and kind of the new face of Lincoln, right, on the new MKZ and the Continental, that new mesh grille, seems to be doing well so far. They've had a lot of hand raisers for the Continental. They're going to be building down in Flat Rock this fall, so... Mm-hmm.
That's a curious thing. I mean, have you noticed that they put that new mesh grille on the MKZ, but they introduced it for the Continental? Yeah. So when I see the new MKZ coming along, I'm like, oh, is that a Continental? And then I realize, when I see the back, it's like, oh, it's the old back. It's the MKZ. I just wonder if that wasn't a big mistake, that they should have held that.
Good question, Gary. That's a great question. Because I've done the same thing.
Sure.
See one coming down the street, and it's like, wow, it's not a Continental.
Yeah,
exactly. And Mike Whalen's pointed out a couple times seeing a few test, Continentals in the wild. Not quite as great as that that floor model or the concept. From a couple auto shows,
the New York Auto Show debut kind. Yeah, no, they.
I've seen some.
They've built it down quite a bit.
Well, too much.
I mean, it's sort of interesting, but I mean, this also gets back to the point, though, that when we see cars in a building, in an auto show, or even in a design dome, and then you see them out on the street, you see them with other cars, you see them parked, you see them, in your rearview mirror. They suddenly take on a whole different look. I mean, a whole different aspect of what these things are like. And so maybe part of it is that when you're up close looking at it, when it's a static thing, you say, oh, I really like this or I like this. But then you see it driving by, you don't catch those details.
It was also a very light brown color.
I saw that same one.
It did not look very well compared to that metallic blue, the shiny chrome grill, and this one had a dull plastic kind of look to it. And I looked at it, and I had to do a triple take just to make sure it was Continental. Mm-hmm. But
getting back to your point between Cadillac and Lincoln, they're going in very different directions, right? Cadillac's more performance. Lincoln's all about quiet luxury, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever that means. So we'll see which one the American consumer enjoys more, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Ford's take is we can't out-German the Germans, right? That gap mm-hmm. is too wide, and we're not even going to try. Cadillac, on the other hand, might be going for that kind mm-hmm. of kind of competition. So, you know, they're a long way off from the other luxury makes, but, you know, we'll see.
And so they really underscored their American luxury thing by becoming the official luxury car of the Dallas Cowboys. Listen, America's team.
I have some problems with that.
I hate the Cowboys.
Me too.
Is that why you have problems with it? Because you hate the Cowboys? That's
the only reason. And a Ford limited edition F-150 for the Cowboys.
Well, I can understand that, right? Texas, large truck market. But I was in the bar yesterday. I saw a commercial with Matthew Stafford for the F-150. When your owner owns the Detroit Lions, it's kind of odd when you're, you know, the official luxury vehicle of the Dallas Cowboys, or making a special edition Cowboys truck. Where's the Lions truck?
They want a winner.
Okay,
they shouldn't pick the Cowboys.
Okay, but here's the thing that I wonder about, though.
Or the Lions.
That's true.
Is I mean, and I don't know what sport this would be that you'd become the official luxury car of, but I mean,
polo.
Yeah, I mean, but I mean, does that, I mean,
it doesn't
football
seem like natural fit?
Yeah, and you know. Kumar Galhotra, the head of Lincoln, was, you know, saying, oh, you know, it's about the experience, and it's about the warmth, and it's about what you remember, and this is why Lincoln is the right choice. I'm like, but, I mean, has he seen a football game?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, like, I think for Lincoln, it's still to the point where they need to get the name out there, right? That's why they got Matthew McConaughey, right? Just to bring people into the brand and bring some buzz back to Lincoln. And, you know, maybe having them, you know, at a football game or commercials on Fox or whatever during the Sunday games, maybe that'll help.
Yeah. Wait, bringing Buzz and Matthew McConaughey in commercials, not saying one word and falling into a pool?
They were corporate. They have people talking at the very least.
Okay, hold on. We got to take a quick commercial break. We got a lot more to talk about, but we're going to give a shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. Hey, we just got a question via Twitter from James Welling. So, Mike Martinez, I'm going to throw it to you since you're the guy who covers autonomous cars. James wants to know which state will have commercial meaning over 25 miles an hour, fully driverless car fleet. Which state do you think would be the first?
Well, first of all, James, I think he follows me on Twitter, so I want to give a shout out to him. I appreciate all the retweets and the favorites. I think Michigan has a great chance to do that, and you saw that by a package of bills that the Senate held a hearing on yesterday up in Saginaw, which I went to. That's why Mike covered the F-150 drive for me. So essentially right now you can test driverless cars in Michigan, but there's no real language about when these things are actually out on the roads. Like, could you actually legally buy one? And so Senate committee headed by Senator Mike Kowal from White Lake, I believe, introduced this package of bills that, one, when they are available, would legally let people buy them and just use them for non-test purposes on the roads.
Is that the first state to do so?
Other states have similar legislation. Nothing's, you know, official yet. It also set up parameters for those commercial fleets, right, which is something that GM is really going to enjoy and something that Ford's going to enjoy, because both of those guys are taking the commercial on-demand autonomous ride strategy in all of this. So it would allow those commercial companies like Lyft or Uber to set up, you know, rides from, say, downtown Ann Arbor to U of M Stadium, or from Detroit to the airport in an autonomous car, one without steering wheels or pedals, too, because right now you have to have a human driver behind the wheel, according to Michigan law, even for testing. But these bills would allow you to take a driver out of the situation, saying you don't need a human to interact in case of an emergency. So you could have the steering wheel-less and pedal-less cars that Ford wants to bring out by 2021. So this bill, it seems like there's great support for it, this package of bills. We'll see what happens when it gets to the Senate floor. But if they do pass it, Michigan would have a pretty good chance to be number one. Obviously, there's a lot of competition. California has some similar bills. And just earlier this week, they amended a bill that's kind of hung up in the process to allow for cars without steering wheels as well. So there's some competition between these two. Also, don't count out states like Florida or Arizona. So
Nevada and Texas, too.
Exactly. It's going to be kind of this knockdown, drag-out fight, but I think Michigan's pretty well positioned.
California's my bet, with Google and them launching the ride-sharing program and the weather. Michigan, unpredictable weather, really. California, don't get that much rain. Mm-hmm. You have the tech guys out there. You have a lot of the automakers out there. Michigan, home of the auto industry. I think we're going to have it, but I think California is going to suck.
Well, and you see that GM is choosing to test, right, their bolts.
Autonomous bolts.
Yeah. Autonomous bolts with Lyft and Cruise Automation out in San Francisco, because those are some tricky streets. You got a lot of hills. You got a lot of people to interact with, and in Arizona as well. So they're testing out there. You know, if these bills pass, you may see them test in Michigan, divert some more resources to their home state, you would think. But lots going on out west for sure.
Well, and there was a new company, Baidu, announced last night that they got their autonomous permit from the state of California.
Sure.
So they're going to start.
Baidu. Really?
Yeah, the Chinese Google, as it's described, is set up, and apparently they have approximately 100 engineers in Silicon Valley who are working on autonomous cars.
Any connection to Faraday Future?
No.
That? No? Okay. Mm-hmm.
So Baidu also, Ford invested a lot of money in
Velodyne,
and Baidu matched them.
Right.
I believe it was $150 or $150 million.
Grand, or $75 million each.
Okay, right. Gotcha. And so split up amongst Ford and Baidu. And Baidu also just announced they're working with NVIDIA now to develop some real-time 3D maps for these.
So the deep learning that you'd been talking about, that's the
hot topic now.
That's the approach that they're taking for developing these vehicles.
Right, where you use artificial intelligence to write all the code instead of an army of software engineers.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So
still need the army of software engineers. Mm-hmm. The artificial intelligence can help them get to a solution faster.
Mm-hmm. So I'm with that, Mike, on California being first.
It'll be interesting. That's
for
sure.
I think those are the two, you know, the two front runners by far, though.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. California. And will it matter?
I don't think it matters to the automakers. I mean, you talk about loyalty, and they all say, yeah, you know, Michigan's our home state. But they're going to test where it makes most sense for them and where their customers are and where the biggest opportunities are.
Sure, so that could be China, exactly. Not just even the U.S.
Well, and the other thing to think about is that, I mean, isn't Uber rolling around with, you know, with
Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh, right? I mean, we're not even talking about Pennsylvania, but, I mean, they've got that close connection with Carnegie Mellon, and, you know, a lot of the autonomous research community is based at Carnegie Mellon University, and so, you know, there's a big core of smart guys who are working on this stuff.
And how about Singapore? You have you have Delphi rolling around in some driverless taxis.
Next year.
You have
somebody's already launched.
Newtonomy, last week, yeah.
So it's happening. I know people keep telling me, oh, we're not going to see this for 30 years. And it's like, dude, it's already on the streets and happening.
I think for you know, the average Joe to go buy one and ride around in it, that's not going to happen. But commercially, and for fleets?
When do you think I can buy one in a showroom?
I'd still say 10 plus, you know, at least a decade. I mean, I think obviously by the end of this decade, commercially, but I think for the average person, it's going to take a while.
Yeah. Mike Whalen, what do you think?
I think heavily automated, even above the Super Cruise or the autopilot right now.
All right, so explain what that means. Explain.
Where you can kind of let your hands off the wheel, and Mike and I were actually in a Tesla Model S with the autopilot earlier this week, where you can let your hands off and just cruise for as many miles as you want from Michigan to Florida. I think that will be by the end of the decade on most of the high-end luxury cars and SUVs, crossovers. However, what we're talking about, the fully autonomous,
no steering
for someone
wheel
to go into and buy. Our autocritic Henry Payne would probably say never, but I'm going to say 20 years. Or
20 years? So he says 10, you say 20?
I just don't, the regulations, the amount, I can see it maybe in Uber or a Lyft, but for a vehicle without any steering wheel or anything like that, I just see it more down the road. The technologies are here, the legislation, the infrastructure and everything, and the liability, I just don't see all coming together for a while, and the acceptance of this. You've got to have it in the fleet. You've got to have it in the rentals to get people more accustomed to it before just putting it out in the showroom. But maybe there will be. I mean, maybe there will be some high-end in the next 10 years, but I just don't see me or you walking in the showroom buying one for another two decades.
And let's be honest. You know, every study that comes out, it seems acceptance it just isn't there. People are still nervous about this. They still don't trust the technology.
Of course, they've never experienced
it. Yeah, I think this is a Sony Walkman phenomenon that, you know, if somebody told you, oh, you're going to be able to have this device and, you know, and Sony said no, and, you know, the music industry has never been the same since, which led to all of the developments that we've had. And it comes down to, okay, so an autonomous vehicle, oh, I don't have a brake, I don't have a steering wheel, I'm not getting in that damn thing, you know, until you experience it,
right?
Yeah. Until you go to the doctor's appointment and the thing is doing it for you. I mean, it's like, well, how perfect. I don't need to call the kids, or I don't have to, you know, if you're an adult, you can just say to the child, you know, go to the store.
Right. So. I think 2025, give or take a year or two each side of that.
10 to 20.
He's the most optimistic.
Well, no, Mike Martinez said 10 years.
Oh, yeah,
10
but it's years, so 2016, you're saying nine.
I'm saying 9 years.
We'll see. It's interesting, right?
There's still some more belts and suspenders that have got to come out yet. But, you know, look at the Tesla system, which doesn't even have a LiDAR. So, you know, it relies on radar and video. You also need sonar. You also need LiDAR. You also need V2V or V2X, let's call it. You get that five levels of redundancy. It's going to be here.
I tell you what, it's something interesting that Ford's doing, right? They made their big splash, you know, their moonshot 2021 commercial application. And along with that announcement, they made a few acquisitions and licensing agreement announcements. And one of those was for Nuremberg Neuroscience. And it's a neuroscientist from New York who's never before, you know, engineered a car, but she's found a way, theoretically, to cure blindness. Now, still in the process of...
Let the blind see.
Exactly. Still going through clinical trials, but she's cracked the code, essentially, to how the brain views images. So they're going to take her work with that into that deep learning, into those algorithms to help their, you know, team up with their cameras and their sensors to help the car see better. So I think that's sort of a fascinating foray into this.
Very much so. Okay, we're going to take another quick break. We're going to come back and from that break with Dr. Data with a number for us to try and parse. But Carmen, let's take that quick break right now. You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go. Okay, we're back. And I keep saying this. We need like a dramatic drum roll or music or something like that. But Dr. Data.
Okay, so this one, last week you got damn close to what it was. And it was just remarkable. This week I'm not so sure. So, Carmen, could you... Well, I mean, because this one's a little... You'll see. Okay, Carmen, bring the first one up. Okay, so we got these two numbers, 2016, 50%, 2009, 24%. Mm-hmm. Now, you look what's behind there.
Bunch of logos.
Car logos, right? Okay, so what could this possibly be?
Well, and, some expired car logos, too, well, on there. I didn't know if that had anything to do with it.
No. All right. Trust me, you're not going to get this.
Okay.
No one's going to get this. Carmen, bring it up what the second is. So this is percent of Americans with positive views of the auto industry. And the remarkable thing is that people think about the industry more positively now than they have like in a decade.
Yeah.
Okay? And so even millennials, which weren't supposed to like cars very much, really like cars more than people who are middle-aged people. They look more positively in the industry.
I mean...
Why is that?
I don't think I'm surprised by that. You look at what everybody's been able to do out of the downturn, there's some damn good product out right now, right? You take from the muscle cars to the luxury cars, every segment. You know, they're fun to drive. You look at the Focus RS and kind of Ford's performance stuff. You look at Cadillac, right? They're doing well with some of their luxury cars, too. And pretty much, you know, the trucks have stayed strong. Every segment you look in... There's something fun to play with.
So better product.
Better product. That helps a lot.
What do you think, Mike?
I think a lot, all those people that were predicting that millennials didn't like to drive were looking at current data. And a lot of the data shows that millennials just delayed getting a driver's license or delayed purchasing a car. So I think it's just they've kind of finally caught up with it. And I'd argue that there's two generations of millennials. One of them, if you slice them down the middle, older generations like me and Mike that grew up with cars, still love cars, got our license when we were 16. Then there's that other half that necessarily aren't interested in cars, but are at the point where they've realized that they need to get from point A to point B. And with the connectivity, the product and the connectivity has gotten so much better even in the past 3 to 5 years that it's easier to connect your cell phone, it's easier to navigate. I just think that the connectivity has come leaps and bounds, and that's what a lot of the younger generations are looking for when they look at a car.
Exactly. I mean, if you're not a gearhead and you don't quite care about the differences in the first generation and the second generation EcoBoost engine in the F-150, well, you have all the, you know.
If you care about the 10-speed transmission, then that's
if you don't like that, you probably care about, you know, Sync 3 and how that's designed and the way you can connect your iPhone and, you know, Android Auto and all that good stuff. And or, you know, the Pacifica with all that high-tech features with the movies in the back seat. And, you know, there's something for everybody. I really think there is.
You know what I think it is? Cheap gas. When gas is expensive, people don't like their cars. Right? Muscle car, you know, right?
You're not going to roll gas, around in those every day.
Gas is cheap. You're like, damn, I like this car.
Yeah.
Goes good. You know? I can drag race with that big load behind me. This is fantastic.
It's all relative, though, because I remember driving around with my parents and gas was still $1, $1.50, and now we're at three-ish still. So, I mean, how do people think about it?
No, but in 2009, gas was expensive.
Yeah, 2000, yeah. Oh, yeah, everybody
right?
hated driving.
Right,
hated
so you hated driving, so you hated the industry, right?
And they love small cars. How things haven't changed. Wait, yeah, they've changed completely.
Hey, we got a couple of responses here from the audience. Don says, problem with the Camaro. It's uncomfortable for most people. My 5 foot, 2 inch wife cannot even see the hood. You know, the cockpit design is not suited for many when there's no up button for the power seats. So, you know, this comes back to what I had said of people complaining that they feel like they're sitting in a bathtub and
right.
don't have good
yeah.
visibility. I don't find that. To me, in most cases, if somebody says, oh, the visibility in this car is bad, I say you got the mirrors adjusted poorly.
Well, I mean, having spent some time in that car, I mean, I found the belt line to be so high that even just looking yeah. out the driver's side window was like I'm seeing a lot of trim, and then I'm seeing glass,
sure.
And then in terms of the looking out the backlight, I mean that was also not exactly a an experience of being in a greenhouse with surrounded by glass.
Well, my grandfather had a Cadillac all the time, and then he went to Buick LaCrosse, and that window at the previous generation was extremely small as well, and he complained about it all the time. But if we're talking about autonomous cars and new vehicles, with backup cameras being standard, are we even going to need that back window anymore? Are you going to need to see out of it if you've got the camera right in the back there? I'm just throwing it out there that maybe GM's kind of going a little bit more into that direction of just making people rely on that camera. But, I mean, I really enjoy the Camaro. But I have heard a lot of complaints about you get in there, and, yeah, you are tight in there, and that might have been the switch to the ATS platform, too, because it just made
smaller.
Less room for them to actually have that interior.
But, I mean, I just wonder if the whole objective was to make the Camaro more of a muscle car, more of a driving car, more of a, you know, a quarter-mile car. And as you were saying earlier, you know, you look at the Mustang when they redid that. They did that knowing full well that they wanted to bring it to places like Europe. And so yeah. you wanted a certain level of sports car, but you still wanted partially muscle car. And maybe what the guys at General Motors just simply said is, no, we're gonna have a hard-ass muscle car, and that's what we're going to do. And you know, we're not going to make this comfortable. We're not going to make this all about, you know, your driving pleasure. We're going to make this about going fast.
If you look at the interiors, too, the Camaro interior, it is smooth, it's sleek, there's not much there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the driver's cars, the new Audi R8 and TT and TTS, they've got those cockpits where you've got the display right in front of you, And then you've got this few switches here, but Ford is still a lot more with the traditional infotainment system up there, and Sync 3 is a hell of a lot better than it ever has been before. So I think I'd agree with you a bit that Mustang, kind of for the average person who's just going to walk up to the showroom, it is a little less aggressive, a little more comfortable for them to just get in rather than the Camaro.
Okay, we got a comment here from Matt. He says, I just had this wild thought. With the forthcoming new generation Wrangler and Wrangler pickup, I think it would be great for them to roll out a jacked up, very hardcore version. Think like a dune buggy almost. Crazy lift kit and suspension. Plenty of power on tap. A Ford F-150 Raptor competitor of sorts. What do you think, Mr. FCA cover guy?
I think Jeep owners already do that enough. Yeah. I don't think Jeep owners want a straight out of the box dune buggy Jeep Wrangler like that. Ram with the Power Wagon to kind of go against the Raptor, fine. With the Rebel, which is pretty much aesthetics, that makes it look more like a Raptor competitor, fine. Jeep does not need to have those bells and whistles out of the gate. They just need to be track capable, keep with their design, and really not piss off the Wrangler owners with the next generation. Last year at the Dream Cruise, I asked the head designer, I said, so, just jokingly, tell me anything about the Wrangler. Well, okay, here it is. It's going to be boxy.
Round headlights?
Round headlights. Seven-slotted grill. Went through all the Jeep
wheel openings.
Yes. Went through all the Jeep characteristics, and that's what they can't do. They cannot make the Wrangler base, man. They can't make the Jeep. While that would be fun for the company, and they've got that Moab concepts, they will do that with. Oh, and they will have fun with that.
Sure. No, they've got Moab, and they've got Rubicon Trail. And the other thing, too, that I would remind Matt is Mopar makes a lot of money selling everything that you're talking about to put on the Wrangler. So I don't think we're going to see it from them, because you can buy the crazy lift kits and, you know, jack the thing way up, and you can get more power and all that. My guess is FCA is going to say, we can't even build the Wrangler fast enough as it is. You know, if we had our own choice, we probably wouldn't even improve anything, because if they're still lining up to buy them, why change anything?
But I wanted to ask you about the Wrangler. So they announced that they just put some new presses into Sterling Heights, and they're going to be stamping Wrangler panels there. Did they mention whether they're going to be stamping steel Wrangler panels or aluminum Wrangler panels?
To the best of my knowledge, they did not. I was actually on paternity leave during that event, but Mike Manley has said that it would feature aluminum features. It would not be all aluminum, but maybe some hanging aluminum here or there, but no, they have not specified that, at least from what I saw. And if you just go back to the Jeepness of Jeep, if you search Jeep Mafia on Twitter, you will see all sorts of those things that he was talking about with the dune buggies, the lift kits, and the powerful engines, the chop tops. I mean, Jeep owners have fun making the vehicles their own. They don't need the company to make it for them.
Well, wasn't this year's Moab, didn't they introduce the Hellcat-powered Wrangler, the Trailcat?
And we keep saying Moab. We mean the Easter Jeep Safari, which the Moab Easter Jeep Safari, where they just have amazingly fun concepts out there, and that one should be fun.
You know, it's interesting, you know, you look at the sales in things like, you know, the Renegade and the Cherokee are doing really, 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 really well for Jeep, and I suspect many of those vehicles are not set up as hardcore Jeep vehicles as we've come to think about them.
We've talked about this before with Jeep. If you put Jeep on anything right now, it's going to sell with the popularity of the compact SUVs, the crossovers, and look at the Compass and Patriot. Those vehicles haven't been touched in years. They're going out, and they are hitting sales marks like crazy because they're affordable Jeeps.
Yeah. Compass up 72% this year. 72%. Why?
I know.
You know what? And they've got the Trailhawk versions now, where if some enthusiasts want to say Jeep isn't Jeep anymore, they can take a Renegade off to the trail and show them for the Trailhawk that maybe it can't do as much as the Wrangler, but it can still do a little bit of off-roading. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, Jeep is Wrangler. That is what the bread and butter is for the brand's personality. And it just trickles down from there, the Grand Cherokee too, but that's not really off-road capable, meant to be, even though they have the Trailhawk version of that. They just need to keep the Wrangler pure and what it's meant to be. The everything else that they do in the lineup, it doesn't matter. As long as they don't make those Wrangler buyers mad, as long as they don't screw up the reputation of the brand. Because they just entered India as a high luxury brand. And they've got the Grand Cherokee SRT there, the Grand Cherokee, and the Wrangler. Mm-hmm. And those vehicles are $100,000 for the SRT, I think more than they are here. And I want to say $60,000 for the Wrangler. So to different countries, different areas, Jeep represents different things. But for here in the U.S., it's capable and it's fun, and that's what they can't mess up. I mean,
right. Good point.
But they've got to keep the Wrangler for the Jeepness.
Yes. Well, and I mean, they can't make enough of them right now. We'll see how much they can actually build once the Cherokee's out of Toledo and over in Belvedere. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that plant, Marchione said, Wrangler will not be built anywhere else. That's what he said. And as much as he goes back and forth on some things, he's never backed away.
Anywhere else in the world?
Yes.
Because I mean, yes. As people may not be familiar, I mean, the Renegade is being built in Melfi, Italy. Is that
yep.
right?
Melfi, Italy, and then also Brazil. But the Wrangler, American, maybe even outside of Toledo, but the Wrangler is American, and that's what it prides itself on globally, is that off-road American capability. So as long as they keep that intact and even whatever else they do with the lineup, the Renegade people were hollering about, I mean, a subcompact Jeep. What kind of Jeep is that? And look at the sales, especially globally. There is a huge demand for that. And the CEO, head of Jeep, Mike Manley, has said that there's even room for a lower rent, smaller than the Renegade. Mm-hmm. Maybe not necessarily here in the U.S., but in other markets such as Brazil or anywhere else.
Okay, hold those thoughts. We've got to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back just shortly, but we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back. And Gary, you always have a long list of things. What's next on the list?
I do have a long list of things. This I thought was rather interesting. So Greg LeMond, who has won the Tour de France three times, as far as we know, completely legitimately won the Tour de France.
Not all doped up, in other words.
And so he started a carbon fiber company with people who have spun out of the Oak Ridge National Lab.
Oh. And they know what they're doing.
They know what they're doing. And so he hired the woman who was in charge of research. They hired a bunch of people. And they came out and they announced that production costs are more than 50% lower than the currently least expensive industrial.
What, they have a new process?
New process. New process to make carbon fiber, 50% less than the currently least expensive industrial grade carbon fiber. The fiber has mechanical properties of fibers costing three times as much as it does in the energy consumed in the process, because making that stuff is rather energy intensive. It's down by 60%. And they're talking to auto companies. LeMond said, quote, "We understand the growing demand from the automotive industry, and we are currently in negotiations with several of the world's leading automotive brands and their suppliers, and they're going to have this stuff commercially available in Q1 of 2018.
Yowza.
So what was it, 2 years ago maybe now that we had Sandy Monroe on here talking about the BMW i3, and BMW has basically established or bought a carbon fiber making company to supply it. If these numbers are real and these performances are real, what do you guys think is going to happen in terms of, you know, we were asking this question, is the Wrangler going to be steel or aluminum? Do we really truly get to the point where there's another option where we're saying, you know, carbon fiber reinforced plastics?
I don't see why not. You look at, in the case of Ford, the GT, right? It's kind of their halo car, and they say a lot of what's on that is going to eventually, it's a test bed for their technology and innovation to trickle down to the rest of the lineup. And you see a lot of carbon fiber parts on that car. So if these guys can come out in 2018 with something that's cheaper and still maintains that performance and capability, I think somebody like Ford, you know, you're going to see them continue to dabble in putting parts on their Halo cars and, you know, maybe on an F-150 or an Explorer or something of that nature.
Those numbers just were daunting to me, but the steel industry has to be a scratch in the head right now. I think it's going to be mixed components still. I mean, for the foreseeable future, even if those numbers are correct, I mean, we are seeing more implementations of carbon fiber on just more traditional vehicles, Corvette per se, and aluminum with the F-150. And, I mean, with the fuel economy standards, you're going to have that. And first thing when I think of carbon fiber, I think of the 4C, the Alfa Romeo. I mean, that's a driver's car, no power steering. And it's amazing the performance that you can get out of that because it's so lightweight. And, I mean, if you were to do, say, a midsize sedan out of that, or let's go to a compact crossover instead because those would actually sell. I think, oh, wow, that would be amazing to actually just be able to have carbon fiber mass-produced for vehicles. Yeah. Because we haven't talked about that too much.
It could be, but remember, you know, you can buy even very ultra-high strength steel for what? Under 40 cents a pound. Aluminum's 75 to 80 cents a pound. Carbon fiber heretofore, $15, $15 a pound. So even if these guys cut the cost in half, you're still looking at $7 versus literally pennies for pounds.
So mixed use, different
things. I think you're right, mixed use. But the thing that I'm more intrigued about, and this is what Sandy talked about when he was here, when you make a car out of carbon fiber, you don't have this massive upfront tooling cost. You're not doing all this stuff. You don't stamp it. You know, you don't weld it. You can lay it up by hand. You can lay it up with robots. So I think Sandy's estimate was that it costs roughly $300 million to tool up a car. We're just talking tooling, none of the other stuff. He thinks BMW tooled it up for a little over $100 million. So right off the bat, you're saving $200 million. And if you're doing low volume, you know, the average car today, even though we're talking about F-Series selling in 500,000 units, it's more like 50,000 is more the average for an individual model. And that's where I think carbon fiber really starts to look attractive.
You know, it was very interesting. So last week I was at a company called Stratasys up in Minneapolis area.
3D printers.
3D printing company. And what they're doing with their 3D printers is they're making tooling for making carbon fiber parts.
No kidding.
So instead of thinking about, okay, we're going to take the local motors approach and we'll print a car. No. What these guys are doing is they're saying, no, what we'll do is we'll print the tooling and then you can use the tooling to make the parts out of carbon fiber. And they even showed a machine that actually prints with carbon fiber.
Yeah.
But I mean, just so to the point of tooling, I mean, if you have this 3D printed tooling and you have this cheap carbon fiber, I mean, you're not going to be able to use this tooling for stamping dies, that's for darn sure.
Right, yeah, you can't have tool-hardened steel.
But
you don't need it with carbon fiber.
Right.
Very interesting. Okay, next on the list.
All right, so this I was very surprised by this. So the NHTSA wants to limit the speed of big rigs. Okay, and so they're basically saying that that large truck collisions accounted for about 4,000 deaths in 2014, and speeding trucks account for about 1,000 deaths annually. So they're saying for trucks that weigh more than 26,000 pounds, speed-limiting devices that will cap truck speeds at, they're negotiating whether it'll be 60, 65, or 68 miles per hour. And the thing that was astonishing to me is it has support of the American Trucking Association and nine of the largest carriers. And Mark Roskind, the NHTSA administrator, said, quote, "This is basic physics. Even the small increase in speed have large effects on the force of impact." Okay, here's what I'm wondering. If a 26,000-pound truck hits you going 68 or going 65, are you going to know the difference?
I don't think so. What I'm curious, though, would this at all have an impact on fuel economy?
Yes.
If this device is going to manage your speed, I think it's more about that. You look at this autonomous platooning technology that everybody's talking about where you have a lead truck followed by a few behind it without drivers, you know, the main impetus for implementing that is to save on fuel economy. So I think this, you know, it's all about those MPGs in this case, because you're right. The, you know, 5 miles or 10 miles difference isn't going to help.
That's sort of the other thing I wonder about is, I mean, isn't there a shortage of truck drivers?
There is.
Okay, so if we're slowing down the existing truck drivers, doesn't that mean that you need more truck drivers?
You could.
I'm betting the Teamsters union and a few other unions who represent truck drivers aren't supporting that too much. The companies might be, because it might be safer and more fuel efficient. And, I mean, they also support the cameras that are looking inward and the cameras looking outward for all the reliability. I was actually just talking to a gentleman who's an expert in fleet ownership, and I was talking to him on the F-150 drive earlier this week, and he said the drivers are hating these cameras that all the companies are implementing. And I think the drivers might have a different opinion about the whole speed limit limitation than the companies. But, I don't see a difference between 5 miles per hour. And not to mention, how many of these truck drivers are getting cut off by other cars that are acting just horribly on the road that we see every single day compared to it actually being the truck driver's fault?
Right.
And we have robot cars. That won't be a problem. I just want you to know that.
Platooning. Mike has covered that before.
To your point, John, I think a truck driver is an endangered species right now. It's not looking good for them with what the technology is available right now. And, you know, they're the first to go. They're the biggest, you know, overhead costs for these companies.
I still think we're a decade away from, you know, autonomous trucks running coast to coast. But I would agree, long term, a decade, those jobs, they're going to go away. Yeah. Not all of them, but a lot of them are going to go away. I think if you talk to truck drivers, they'll tell you that what is a safety hazard is not trucks speeding per se. It's the difference in speed between vehicles. So if everyone's going 70 miles an hour, a truck is completely safe. But if a truck is going 60 and everyone else is going 70, 75, 80 miles an hour and going around it and trying to cut into the next, I think that creates a more dangerous situation. Mm-hmm.
And when you're in these highly autonomous vehicles, too, even with the adaptive cruise control, that you leave a little bit of a barrier for cars to cut into, that works fine if everyone's doing that and leaving that barrier. But as soon as someone cuts in front of you, your car slams on the brakes a little bit. And if the car behind you isn't paying attention, you're going to get rear-ended even if you've got that space in front of you. So it's really everyone's got to do it to make it safe. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know about lowering the speed just 5 miles per hour.
You know, you mentioned the Teamsters, and I happened to just notice by accident, and I don't know why this is the case, that the Canadian Auto Workers Association, what, it's Unifor now or something like
Unifor.
That they've announced that they may strike next week?
It's interesting. They took a really hard line in the sand at the start of negotiations. They said, if we don't get new investment in some of these plants, and there's one for each, Ford, GM, and Fiat Chrysler, if we don't get new investment, you know, no deal.
So they've identified three plants, and they said?
There's Windsor for Ford, the engine plant. There's Oshawa for GM, and then Brampton for Fiat Chrysler. And they're at risk. You know, they feel if there's no new investment in this next round over the next 4 years, the automakers will likely close them and look elsewhere.
Particularly Oshawa. Our colleague Melissa Byrne just was up there talking with workers, talking with officials, and even the company about it, because all of the products that they make in Oshawa right now are made in other plants. And GM, unlike some of the other automakers, isn't necessarily capped for their production right now compared to Fiat Chrysler, which needs more production for their trucks. So, yeah, Oshawa and Ford's engine plant and Brampton, which hasn't publicly had a lot of investment in recent years, have all been kind of earmarked by the union to, we need investment here now.
And this is their way of saying, listen, Canada still matters. Let's be honest, right now they're kind of fighting for scraps, right? Mm-hmm. You have the U.S. that they promised the UAW billions in investment last year. Then you have Mexico where you can build things for super cheap. So those are kind of, you know, the first two options if you're an automaker. And Canada is kind of an afterthought. So they're saying, no, we don't want to be that afterthought. We want new investment. We want more jobs. And we want some new products coming in here.
Well, there's an asterisk there, though. Windsor Assembly with the Pacifica.
Right.
I think Fiat Chrysler's negotiations are going to go much smoother than Ford and GM, because they cannot afford to have that plant down, and they just invested billions in that plant. So I can see their negotiations going much more smoothly than Ford or GM.
But Brampton is the 300, the Charger, and the Challenger. Is there anything else there?
No.
No.
And
doesn't Ford still have Oakville, too?
Ford does still have Oakville, and that makes the Edge and the MKT. So they're fine there. But their only issue is the Windsor engine plant, which makes, you know, some engines for heavy-duty trucks, yeah, which they could easily probably move. But you look at the coming negotiations in terms of a strike, GM has said we're not going to announce new investment until after these talks. So they're already butting heads on day one in negotiations. Ford and FCA have said we're open to potentially, you know, working with you guys and maybe announcing new investment in the midst of talks. So you could see something happen there, but GM and Unifor, it's not looking particularly good.
And that's completely different than GM and the UAW when they're announcing tens of millions of dollars of investment prior, hundreds of millions of dollars prior to the UAW negotiations, which was kind of an odd situation in the beginning, but then it made a lot of sense going into the talks, and GM needed it, particularly in Flint. I remember I was at an event, I was asked them, why are you announcing this now? And they go, we're not going to use this as a bargaining chip. We need this now.
So what is made in Oshawa? I mean, what would they conceivably lose?
Silverado is made there. And I want to say, is La Crosse?
It's the Equinox.
That's a different plant. That's
isn't that
the old
Ingersoll?
Cammy
Ingersoll?
Plant.
They've got two lines up there.
Right,
and
the
Silverado,
they do
I don't...
somebody's in Ingersoll and ship them to
yes.
Oshawa, right.
And the La Crosse is up there, I believe. And it just, all the vehicles up there now, they just
Impala?
Haven't been invested. Yes, the Limited, Impala Limited.
Is that the old one?
Yes, that yeah, they kept around
the
for
Impala's fleet. Because new Impala's in Hamtramck.
Yeah, that they kept around for fleet. So literally all of those vehicles up there
like the Malibu
have
classic.
Other...
Yeah, like that, the classic.
Well, I think they brought... Did they have the... Don't they have a Malibu Limited now, too? I think they brought that back for the fleet ones, so they kept the old Malibu around so they could keep the consumers going to the new one.
Killing costs.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's going to be interesting. Mike was up, Martinez was up there for the actual launch, and it was very much different from what he said about the UAW.
For sure, and President Jerry Diaz brought up that very fact. He said, listen, GM says, you know, if it's good enough for the UAW to invest early on and to work together, it's good enough for us. And they, like I said, day one, they were butting heads, so it's going to be interesting.
It'll be interesting.
Come the
19th. Unifor is on thin ice myself. I don't think they got much bargaining power. And long term, I mean, all of Canada is very worried about it.
Yeah.
From a technology and engineering standpoint, no. I think they're in a really good position. From a blue collar, working on the line, building cars, those days are numbered.
Well, and Unifor, I mean, we talked about the Canadian auto workers previously. Unifor is now a much larger union that doesn't have to rely as on the auto industry as heavily first membership, too. So while the auto is on thin ice, the union as a whole, I don't think, is off too bad. But, yeah, and you also had years of government that wouldn't subsidize any investments. That was one of the biggest problems, was the regime there just would not subsidize anything, give any incentives to the automakers. And Sergio Marchionne had very harsh words for the government at the time.
Stephen
for
Harper.
The Windsor.
So now we'll get Justin there and it'll all be good, though.
Yeah. Promised. They have promised to help investment.
See?
And Unifor has been in talks with the government with that. So I think that last regime kind of might have just tapped the nail in to the coffin for most of that auto up there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, hey, we got to wrap the show up, but Mike and Mike, it's been great for us to be mic'd up.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, guys. Always fun.
Good deal. You're going to be around next week, Gary?
Yes, I will.
Let's do another show then.
Why don't we try that?
Okay, and we invite all of you to tune in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv. We still got some audience questions here.
Bonus time.
Let's see. Our work says, so I will see again as when the limit was 55 miles an hour. You guys might remember that.
These guys don't remember that.
No, you have left lane backup.
They read about it. Yeah.
So, yeah, what he's saying, you're going to have left-lane backups on the Pennsylvania Turnpike by truck drivers. And he says, all this lightweighting means that as you add components, the effects on performance will be altered more radically than with cars with more mass. Well, that's true. If a car is light and you add mass to it, you'll notice it more than a heavy car to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The Griffin says speed-limited trucks have been done overseas already. I got to tell you, around here in Michigan, when I'm driving in this local area, the trucks pretty much do 65 already. I think the trucking companies have already decided for safety and fuel economy to do that. Bradley G. throws this out. Okay, Mr. Autonomous guy who covers this stuff, how will autonomous cars deal with Midwest winter conditions?
Nobody knows yet.
I mean, that's one of the...
That's
one of the major components or problems and that they're trying to address is when the sensor gets blocked, and LiDAR would take care of that, but you can't, not everybody can afford a LiDAR. But
it's gonna get cheap.
Dirt cheap.
And you see, Ford's already tested on snow and ice at M City, so they're
right.
They're
and that was one of the other questions: has anyone tested it? Ford has tested.
Right.
I remember. Was it 2 years ago? We had Jeff Owens from Delphi here, and we asked him, "What about snow?" And he says that's been solved.
Right.
So.
Yeah,
it's been solved, but it comes at a cost. I mean, and Jeff's a.
No, but see, but I think the thing of it is that, I mean, you look at companies like Delphi, Continental, Bosch. All these guys are chasing that stuff, and you know it's gonna have like a Moore's law is going to apply to all of these sensors, okay? Because historically there has been no need for mass produced LiDAR systems, right? Yeah. I mean, it just didn't exist.
Well, look at Velodyne though; prices of those things are just plummeting.
Right, But if you look at a Velodyne system, they're still about the size of a large soup can, right?
Well, they got them down to a hockey puck now.
Yeah,
but I mean, you're looking at what Continental's doing is like, you know, the size of a cigarette lighter. I guess nobody knows what those are anymore either. But
Zippo or a Bic?
Yeah. Okay, Fritz wants to know: is there a buzz on who has the best battery technology in the next year or two around Detroit?
Hmm. You know, I talked with Henrik Fisker the other day.
Uh-huh.
He said it was an interesting conversation.
Oh, yeah, he says he's got a breakthrough coming,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, he's working on a breakthrough, but we'll see about
that. Here's the stylist artist who has come up with a breakthrough.
So he has a battery technology breakthrough?
That's what he said. He's been working in secret on the latest in electric vehicle battery technology. So we'll see if he implements that. Revives Fisker, maybe. Who knows? He said he still owns the naming rights and all that, so... might bring it back. Who knows?
So maybe he could just call the new company The Real Henrik Fisker.
There you go. Just like on Twitter.
I was going to say the Chevy Bolt with a B, not a V. I think it's going to be really interesting to drive around and see on the road. 200 miles plus, 35K. And he said in the next year. And I do not believe Tesla's going to be out in the next year or so for the Model 3. So I'm going to say the Chevy Bolt.
So, but I mean, is... the battery technology, who is the...
That's LG.
LG?
Yeah. Now, Ford has said when they made their big electric push, late last year, the details are escaping me, but they were talking about some of their battery technology with the some of the products they're using, and they said they've made advances, and they've yet to announce, you know, the Model E or things of that nature. So they're still a few years away on that, so we could see some announcements here pretty soon.
How about the C-Max? Is that even still around?
Yeah, still around.
Not selling that, you know?
Probably not so
like
well.
Let's just see. Fusion EV, they don't sell many of them
either. This year they've sold 13,721, down a mere 10.5%.
Going to Mexico,
all
probably.
All California.
Yeah, I would bet, yeah.
No, my wife has one.
Really?
Yeah.
She likes it?
She does.
More police interceptor utilities have been sold.
Yeah. Let's see, what else here? Fritz also wants to know, will the next small Cadillac crossover be available in all electric? Didn't Johan just come out and say, we're not doing electrics? Not anytime soon. I think he did.
I remember talking to him when the CT6 was being launched, and he was just talking about the cadence of what they've got to do. I mean, they've got to... do the basics and get that right before they start doing things that would be, you know, alternative powertrain sort of things. But on the other hand, you think about it. I mean, Samsung just announced that they're building a new battery plant, I think, Hungary, to serve Mercedes for its battery needs. So if Mercedes starts rolling out with, you know, all types of electric vehicles, how can Cadillac not?
And that's what I was going to say was look at Ferrari or some of the bigger, I mean, even Tesla. The battery power does you give you that instantaneous torque for the electric.
Right.
And then if you want an engine for the high horsepower and higher RPMs, sure, why not? But Cadillac has other problems right now.
Yeah,
I think, look, there's no natural demand for electric cars. Not in big demand, except for Tesla, maybe. So Cadillac doesn't need to do it. Mercedes does. Cadillac doesn't. General Motors does, but General Motors is going to use Chevrolet right now to try to do it. No, I think it's going to be fascinating. I think the tipping point is still 7 to 8 years away before the general public starts to go, you know, maybe we should get an electric.
I've been still wondering about Buick. Buick has been doing very well. They're going to have almost all their cars be crossovers, and that's where their sales are going to be. Why not start putting more electric in that? Because that buyer base, I think, is fuel economy, not necessarily full performance, and just trying out some electric.
And you sell a whole lot in China.
Yeah.
Well, I think everyone's going to watch what happens with the Bolt with a B and the Model 3. And if the Bolt takes off and stays strong for a couple of years, everyone's jumping in the pool.
I think it might have to stay strong for a couple of years for the Model 3 to even come out.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. I don't trust Elon to bring it out by the end of 17 with his production of 500,000 by 2018 from 2020 when they had two head of productions quit when they were announcing the goal. And they're having trouble just producing niche Model Xs and Model Ss. No. He might be sleeping on the assembly line with his sleeping bag, but I do not see the Model 3 coming out by the end of next year.
Didn't you see Iron Man? I mean, come on. Tony Stark can do anything.
Tony.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I think they'll miss their production target. Plus, now all the rumors are out that they got to go through another massive run of raising money, like $3 billion, because they're going to be out of cash in no time. So we'll see.
They'll start a GoFundMe page.
There you go. We probably do a whole other show just on Tesla for now.
Oh, yeah. No. Well, obviously, you know, look, everybody in the business wants to talk about Tesla.
All right. I want to ask you guys a very controversial question.
Ooh.
Okay. I was looking at the numbers. Should Honda kill Acura?
Ooh.
Okay. So here's the thing. Total Acura sales so far this year have been 106,914 units. And that is down 8.9%.
Hmm.
Okay, now, here's what I was thinking, that, okay, you get good margins on electric cars. That's why people are on electric cars, right? And so you say, okay, they get good margins, even though they're not selling so many, they ought to keep them. But then I was looking, what else do you get good margins on? So they get good margins on the Odyssey and the Pilot, right? And both of these things are, you know,
profitable.
Larger.
Yeah, I mean, they're large vehicles. They have big price. I mean, you can get economy ones, but they have big price tags. And so I added up the Odyssey and Pilot sales so far this year, 167,620. Okay, so this is roughly 60,000 more units of those two
than the entire Acura brand.
Wow.
Wow.
I was going to say, if they're making money off Acura, no. That was my first initial reaction,
Then
you brought that up. And I don't think it's doing much for them, to be honest.
What other markets are the Acura brand in?
I think this is it.
Is it just the U.S.?
Really? Yeah. Because in Europe, the NSX is a Honda.
It's a Honda.
Right? And I don't
think Acura is in Honda, or the Acura brand's in Europe at all. I don't know if
maybe,
it's in Japan.
Maybe it's maybe.
I was thinking Japan. That was the only other market
maybe,
I was thinking of.
But I'm not sure if it is or not. But, I mean, okay, just in this market.
Great question, Gary. Should they kill it off?
I'd like to test out that NSX first, though, before they do.
No, that wouldn't go away, okay? Yeah. I mean.
Might be a Honda.
No, but, I mean, but it's just like, you know, I mean, I'm thinking, with the exception of the last time we had the MDX in studio, okay, when do we even talk about Acura?
At the Detroit Auto Show, I think they had a round table there talking about it.
But when do we talk about it?
But is the MDX their only crossover?
They got the RDX.
Okay.
But
Maybe they just need more crossovers? I don't know.
Maybe I don't know their product line as well as I should, but, I mean, aren't a lot of these just rebadged Hondas where they can just charge a higher ATP?
They're more than rebadged.
No. Yeah, no, I wouldn't say
I mean,
that.
There's a lot of common componentry, but I wouldn't call them rebadged.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's just, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, here's a brand that really never gained traction in the market. I mean, maybe early on when they had Dennis Miller during those commercials, and they had very inexpensive upscale Hondas that went really fast. And but, man, I just don't see.
You think they should say sayonara, kind of like how Scion did?
I don't know. I mean, it just puzzles me.
Yeah, no, it depends on the margins and, you know, if they're getting anything out of it.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
I can't see the NSX being a Honda here. It just wouldn't make sense to me, but.
Well, but maybe what you do is that, you know, and we talked a little bit about this last week. I mean, Genesis, the new Hyundai division, yeah. And you mentioned Scion. Well, so basically you could have a boutique within your Honda store that would be selling, you know, special vehicles like the NSX.
And Hyundai's doing great right now. Subaru, I mean, a bunch of those are. But Hyundai, I've been really impressed. We talked about Hyundai on the show last time because they were ranked number one. So, I could see them doing that and just killing off Acura. Will they? Let me ask that.
Probably not. But, I mean, when I was just going through the numbers.
That's very interesting.
What a strange thing.
They haven't really been able to crack the luxury market because it's really not a luxury brand. It's a premium brand.
I'd say they're a luxury brand. All right. So before Steve Kincaid's head explodes, I should probably point out that actually with the year-to-date sales of 106,914 cars and trucks, they've outsold Lincoln handily. Okay. So
106,000 for Acura. And what'd you say Lincoln's at? About
a total of 72.
Oh, 72. Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
So there you go. But
we'll keep Acura for now.
But there are some black ink for Lincoln, and there is virtually MDX is still doing okay. Well, but not for the year. RDX is up 0.4%.
I was going to say, like our friend Michelle Krebs says, 0 to 5 miles per hour for Lincoln still, because I'm thinking back 5 years ago when they showed off the new design of Lincoln, and it was after they killed off the
Nowadays, can companies afford to go 0 to 5 in a long period of time? I think not.
When
you are able to buy that Faraday future, damn, you're going to be all over it.
When you are selling 500,000 pickups plus and yes. You're selling number one for 37 mm-hmm. years, you can keep Lincoln.
I was going to say, I think Ford can afford to do that.
All right. Another question. We got to end this at some point, but this is one more.
One more question.
Okay. So, you know, we were talking about FCA and about the plant in Canada, not the Pacifica plant, but the one up in
Bramley.
And this caught my eye. Okay, so year-to-date, there have been 39,291 300 sold.
Yeah.
Okay. Or no, I'm wrong. 39,000, I'm sorry.
Okay. 39,300.
34,000 darts. Mm-hmm. Okay. There's a difference of less than 5,000 units between those two. Dart gets killed. 300 remains. How is that possible?
The architecture. I mean, the Dart is in Belvedere with the Jeeps. Jeeps are selling. The Dart is a compact sedan. The 300 still has the Charger and the Challenger. If you add up all three of them, you can make the business case for it. The Dart has the Dart. And get that out of there. Once the compatriot replacement, whatever they're going to call it, likely the Patriot or Compass would be my guess.
That was pretty clever. They had to call it Compatriot.
I am not going to take credit for that. that was at a FCA event. Another journalist said the Compatriot is what we've been referring to it as a lot. Once that is built in Mexico, you get the Cherokee in Belvedere.
Yeah.
You get Wrangler in Toledo.
Yeah.
that's cemented. However, the 300 Charger and Challenger, that plant's still up in the air. And Marchionne did drop a very slight kind of mention that Windsor could build a 300.
On a new platform.
Yes.
See,
or is capable of building it.
Yeah, right, right. Well, that was like, that was a shot across the bow of Unifor, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the reasons they can keep that plant going is, remember, that platform goes back to Daimler Chrysler. Yeah. That was a gift of Mercedes to Chrysler. How many years was that ago? I mean, that is such an old...
You guys probably don't remember. You probably read about that. But 55 you know, mile an hour speed limits, Daimler Chrysler. These are things you remember.
John, that is one of my favorite questions to Tim Kaniskis, the head of the passenger car.
When the hell are you going to update that car?
When are you going to update that platform? When are you going to kill this platform? And you know what he tells me? Why? I go, it's heavy. It's going behind everything else that all of your other competitors are doing.
Right.
And he goes, you know what? You put a 707 horsepower engine in it, and no one complains about it anymore.
Yeah.
You put a 392 Hemi in it, no one complains about it anymore. It's from the auto journalists who know what's going on in the industry, how old that architecture is, that are complaining about it more than the actual public.
Right.
Because if you look at the sales of the Charger and Challenger and even the 300 to a point,
they're doing pretty good.
Yeah, they're doing fine, especially in a truck and SUV market.
Right. But and I totally buy what he's saying. Except that I've seen it happen before. You think this platform is just fine until the day it isn't any fine, and then you don't have anything behind there ready to slap into its place, and then you're really caught out.
Oh, I completely agree with you. I was just saying what he
says.
No. And I mean, you get into that car, and if you get into a entry level, I mean, you can feel it. It's heavy,
and you can
hear it from the outside.
Yeah.
When you don't have a 707 horsepower engine that you want to hear rattling around, and you're just in a V6 or a Hemi right there, you can hear a lot of stuff in that car with the acoustics.
No, I mean, look, I just was in a Hellcat for the Dream Cruise. It was a fantastic car, Challenger. But I hadn't been in one in a couple of years. So, you know, I've been through Mustangs, been through Camaros, getting that thing, and it's like, wow, is this thing big? Wow, is this thing heavy? I mean, you feel it. But I'll say this.
You were in a real car.
I know. But the car looks great.
Yeah.
It's really roomy. It's very comfortable. It rides like a dream.
You can actually fit people in the back seat. You said, Mustang Camaro, no, thank you.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, and, you know, you put it in fifth and sixth. I had a six-speed manual. It's kind of noisy, but you put it in fifth or sixth and you're cruising, it's not noisy at all. And it doesn't jar you over the bumps. I mean, so I can see where a lot of people, especially bigger people, go, this is my kind of car. I can fit in it and I'm comfortable.
That eight-speed torque flight transmission, too, out of ZF is great in that car. It performs smoothly. And while they haven't updated the architecture, they've done a lot with that interior and a lot of the components. Mm-hmm. I mean, but I see Tim Kunis. Whenever I see him, I ask him that question every time.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting, though. I mean, the auto industry, by and large, has abandoned big people.
No.
In terms of cars?
In terms of cars, I would agree. But this is another reason. This is another untalked reason about why trucks and SUVs do so well. A lot of Americans just can't fit in most passenger cars. I mean, physically cannot get in there.
Maybe that explains Fiat.
But then maybe that explains why Tim is not going to change the 300, right?
Then in capital investment,
well,
and
that's
things
that's
along right, with that. Right. But we'll see what happens. If Unifor wants investment, and they've already invested in Windsor, and they need to invest in Brampton, how much investment is going to take to redo those three cars? And there's been rumors of the Barracuda. Mm-hmm. If you put all four of those on there and do a new platform, I think you can sell enough cars on four different
brands. Look, I think it's all bargaining with Unifor. And it's like, of course we're not announcing anything. What are you going to give us?
True.
And Ontario, what are you going to give us? And you know, Trudeau, what are you going to give us? I think it's all, you know, about bargaining.
Actually, I haven't been in a 300 in quite some time. Have you guys?
About a year.
But yeah, no, it's probably been a couple of years for me.
Isn't Challenger in charge of the 392 Hemi Hellcat? Yeah, I mean, like you said, you're in it. You can feel it's heavy, it's big. It doesn't really matter what that engine.
Right, but 300 sales were up last month.
Probably, yes.
I mean, it's not like the numbers are going gangbusters, but in a market that was down, I want to say 300 was up.
Yeah, they were up 19%. They're up 90% calendar year to date, and they're up 22% month over last year. But again, I mean, we're talking less.
Small numbers.
We're talking less than 40,000 vehicles for the year. I mean, that's.
But when we're talking about the average car doing 50.
Yeah.
It's not
okay, but charge. Okay, but here, Charger, 67,000. Charger, Challenger, 45.5.
Entry level pricing, though, for those vehicles too, and the amount of investment they've put into them, and they're not going to drop the 300 anytime soon, because then Chrysler would just have the Pacifica, unless they're going to become the minivan brand, which they already kind of are. But they need to have some new cars in there, some new crossovers, and we'll see what happens up in Windsor with that.
Yeah.
Because that's one thing. Good thing about these negotiations is they do tell a lot about what's going to happen over the next 2 or 3 years for a lot of the four years for a lot of the products too. That's going to be going in there, but see.
All right.
Okay, let's go home.